Amen. Amen. Well, Solomon himself, the great man, Solomon, lying in the ointment. Pretty so. As a matter of fact, if you'll notice here in 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 11, God has said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, I will have, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. What servant would it get the kingdom? Most of it, 10 tribes of it.
Jeroboam.
Okay? And God did not do this in Solomon's day for David's sake, but it would happen. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, is the one that put enough pressure on Israel. They irritated them enough that they were ready to rebel. But who sowed the seed?
Solomon
did. Okay? So when Solomon writes this, what we have in Ecclesiastes 10, he's supposed to do anything about this sort of thing, about flies in the ointment? Whether or not he had done this at the time he wrote Ecclesiastes, I don't know. But he's well acquainted with the process, and there are so many examples of this sort of thing in the scriptures and the history of them. Verse 2, and we're looking at a number of things. Some of these things are a little bit nebulous, dark. Hard to figure out just exactly what Solomon is driving at, but nonetheless, I think good material and a little bit of an interlude, as one writer put it, between what Solomon has been saying and what he is going to be doing in chapter 11 and 12 as he winds this writing down. But he goes on to say, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's hand is at his left. You ever heard anything about left-handedness being a sign of wickedness of the devil? I am not going to touch that wrong point in the Well, you don't hear that much anymore, but there was a time back when I was a little boy and before my father was a natural left-hander. And his mother, in particular, would not let him grow up left-handed because it was a sign of the devil. She forced him to be a right-hander. When I came along, I'm ambidextrous, but one thing in particular, anything I do with two hands, I do left-handed. My father had learned the lesson from his own mother, don't mess with it. He let me grow up left-handed, batting, using tools, whatever. But I'm right-handed with things I do one-handed. Okay, maybe the devil is there. But our expression, sinister, comes from the word for left-handedness. And so Solomon is drawing upon that. The wise man draws from the right. It's the good hand. You recall that Jesus, when he described the judgment, all nations brought before him, and he will separate them, sheep from goats. The sheep being his people will be where?
Right hand.
Goats?
On the left.
And so Solomon is just drawing on that conception to point out wisdom. It comes from the right, he says. Even when a fool, this is verse 3, even when a fool walks along the way, he lacks wisdom. And he shows everyone that he is a fool. This is nature, and he's going to demonstrate his foolhardiness no matter what. I made a little note here from Proverbs 29 and verse 11. The fool vents all his feelings. I think the old King James puts it, the fool expresses all his heart, everything that's on his mind. But a wise man holds them back Have you ever heard, if you think, you might just as well say it?
Yeah.
Wrong. A lot of things that enter into our mind that are better kept to ourselves. It is the fool who says everything that's on his mind. Sometimes an afterthought. You know, that was really not a very good thing to have said. I'm glad I didn't say it. Or all too often, that was not a good thing to say. I'm sorry I did. Okay? If the spirit of the ruler, it's hard to connect exactly how all these things fit together. And yet they're grouped by the publisher of the text. If the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post. For conciliation pacifies great offenses. This is the thing we see pretty often. A person working at something feels unappreciated. Perhaps raises the ire of the boss or the officer or whoever it is that he's accountable to and says, what? Well, that's the way he feels about it. I quit. What's Solomon saying? Don't do that. Work it out. Conciliation will bring about a better result. Okay? All right. At verse 5, Solomon says, there is an evil I have seen under the sun as an error proceeding from the ruler. This comes down then from high, from one who is in authority. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in a lowly place. I have seen servants on horses, while princes walk on the ground like servants. Now this goes back to Solomon's day. And later, for example, we'll go further on up to the 1st century B.C. and into the 1st century A.D. When you see, and I think we've all seen movies or pictures, here's a Roman legion commander and his immediate staff. Are they walking into battle? Or are they mounted? They're mounted. Field grade officers and infantry, how do they go into battle? On foot. The better get turned around. That's what Solomon said. He said, I've seen something that's evil. If the person who should be a servant, the holy person, he's writing while the person of authority is afoot. Can you think of an example of that? Bible example.
Mordecai, the king dressed him in royal garments and made him ride on one of his horses while Haman led him down the street and shouted his honor.
All right, and of course, when Mordecai got into trouble, here is Haman who is riding, and Mordecai refused to bow to him. And that got him into a lot of trouble from his point of view, but that got turned around eventually. Another example that I had in mind is Absalom, the son of David. David, at this time, had pretty well disgraced himself. It was promised him that trouble would come to him from his own house. His son Absalom is doing the very best he can to undermine David's influence, and did. And David had to flee, apparently with abandonment and on foot, while Absalom occupies his palace and takes over all of his goods and reigns as king until finally this all comes down to David's commander in chief, Joab, will wind up eventually killing Absalom. But good example. What should Absalom have been to David? Not only a son, but a servant. then he usurps authority, and David winds up walking in her dad's home in the saddle in more ways than one. Solomon says, I've seen that. It's an evil, and it happens. All of a sudden it occurred to me that close to our time, there was a fellow, he was an Austrian soldier, a corporal in rank, not very high even in enlisted ranks, who was very ambitious and very skillful, and just an excellent speaker, could win the thoughts of people and desire to be ruler of the world. Who am I talking about?
Adolf
Hitler. Yes. Beware, just because one can speak does not mean that he is a good leader. Listen to what he says. The Germans should have read Mein Kampf and understood what Hitler was actually talking about. Maybe the millions of people that died because of his doing would not have. Okay. At verse 8, this little section, I would, you know, if somebody had asked me to write little captions like you see sometimes in the Bible, and New King James has them, I would put a caption here called Murphy's Law at Work. Because this is exactly, I think, what Solomon is talking about. He who digs a pit will fall into it. You ever seen that happen? I saw it happen one time, literally. Digging a deep hole for a septic tank, and the fellow stumbled and falls into the hole that he just dug himself and needs help getting out of it. Kind of ridiculous. Whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. Snakes like to hide out in places like that. These old rock buildings built with clay, brick, and so forth. There's an old deserted mill that is made entirely of wood, and I think I'm correct. Don't, if you're taking notes, don't write this down, but I'm not sure, but I think it's in Winslow, Arizona. And it's an old abandoned mill in an area that's kind of a tourist area for sightseers. And all over this old mill, and every door that's, well, they're all nailed shut pretty well, but over every door, do not enter. Rattlesnakes. This old building is full of snakes. You couldn't find them in a place like that. What kind of rattlesnakes does Arizona have? We have a little timber rattlers here. 3 footers is a pretty good sized snake. What do they have down there?
Yeah, exactly.
Western diamondbacks. And they get big. Stay out of the building. You don't want to get snake bit. How would you like to be a contractor, given the contract for tearing that old mill down? Maybe that's why it's still standing. Nobody wants to tear it down. But Solomon says the man, you know, just here, Murphy's Law at work. He's busy. He breaks through a wall and gets snake bit. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them. And he who splits wood may be endangered by it. Not very difficult to get hurt quarrying stone, is it? That's heavy, hard work. They just take one slip and the fellow can really get messed up. As far as splitting wood, I think other translations say splitting logs. I think we're all familiar in this part of the country with the logging industry. Years ago, a long time ago, Mark and I were living in a little town on 101 in California called Willits. It's just south of the Redwoods, just north of Ukiah, about 140 miles or so, maybe 150 north of San Francisco. And back then it was a logging community, logging and mills. It isn't so much anymore. The woods have been pretty well shut down, and the mills as a consequence of shut down. But then it was logging. It was all logging. There was a man in town who ran a gypo outfit of his own with his sons. worked at it all his life and built up a pretty good business and was doing okay. The last day he was to work, he was going to retire. The very last day he was to work, his son came in with a log truck full of logs. The father loosened one of the bands, and off comes the log and kills him dead at his doorstep. Happens at Murphy's Law. I recall preaching a funeral for a logger. It was actually over in Fort Bragg on the coast, and this was back when you were still allowed to cut some of the redwood, big trees, and this logger was taking down one of these redwoods, and as it went, it just turned on the stump, and just the weight of that turning on the stump crushed one of his sides. Who would have thought that would happen? Well, the tree's supposed to maybe undercut it and down it goes. This one turned. And it happens. Again, Murphy's Law at work. Solomon is just saying, who knows? You know, these things occur. If the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. Right? Take more strokes. Takes more strength to make the axe work. I recall a number of years ago, I was visiting in the home of a man that I knew very, very well. And I was helping him and his wife prepare supper. I was given the job of cutting up a salad with a knife that was as dull as you could possibly imagine. And the man said, I keep it dull so it won't cut anybody. Bad idea. Well, the duller the knife is, what do you have to do with it? Put more pressure on. When you put more pressure on, what can happen? It slips. You cut through something all of a sudden, and you get nailed. Not a good idea. With a dull axe, a sharp axe, actually a sharp bit, it will dig in and cut. If it's got a dull bit to it, what is likely to happen? It goes in and turns and comes right back out. And people that have not learned not to stand on a piece of wood that they're trying to cut learn the lesson the hard way when that axe comes out and hits them in the foot. Murphy's Law, but there it is. This is practical stuff, isn't it? And so wisdom brings success. Solomon says, figure it out. Use your head. Common sense. Okay, next section. A serpent may bite when it is not charmed. I think we're all familiar with the vision of the snake charmer. And I guess there are some people that can actually do that. But if the serpent, that's usually done with what kind of a snake? Cobra. Cobra. Okay. And then you hit a sour note, what may he do? He may get nailed. And so the serpent that is not charmed may bite. How about the bad bird? Look at the latter part of that verse, verse 11. The bad bird is no different. One who has not been, quotation mark, charmed, and has not been able to absorb the fact that it's not easy to be constantly talking, particularly if you don't know what you're talking about, can bite. And so it is. Hang on just a second. See if I can find really what I want here. Proverbs 26. And at verse 20, where there is no wood, what happens with the fire? No wood, it goes out, right? And Solomon, hearing the proverb, goes on to say, where there is no tail bearer, strife ceases. No battling. No on and on. But the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. Now, that's funny. Can't you just see that in a cartoon? Here's a person with a huge mouth and babble, and his mouth is so big and it works so much all the time, he swallows himself. That's a cartoon figure. You know, people that think there's no humor in the Bible have to read it very carefully. That's funny. But it's also dead serious. What Solomon is warning about is that this babbler is destroying him or herself. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. You ever had a conversation with someone that they get started on something and it's just as haywire as can be? If you let them keep talking, they get wilder and wilder until it's just absurd. As Solomon puts it here, raging madness. A fool also multiplies words. No man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? The labor of fools wearies them, but they do not even know how to go into the city. Let's revisit this passage that we talked about earlier in Ecclesiastes, back in chapter 5, and beginning in verse 1, verse 1 through 3, Ecclesiastes 5, 1 through 3. Solomon says, walk prudently. How do we put that in our time? Watch your step. Right? When? Watch your step, walk prudently when you go to the house of God. If we go to the house of God, and to God's dwelling, of course God dwells in heaven, but we approach him in prayer. What kind of attitude should we have?
Reverence,
okay. I'm going to go up and talk to God, and I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. I'm going to let him know what I think about this or that. And some things that he's commanded that I just don't think are necessary. I'm going to tell him what he needs to think about. That sound right to you? Diametrically opposed to the way it should be. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear or to listen. That's what old King James. All right. My publication of it has to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. What is the sacrifice of a fool that Solomon has in mind here? His own words, spoken in the presence of God without respecting God as and for what God is. Okay, the sacrifice of a fool, his own words. For they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you on earth. Therefore let your words be few, for a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. Babble. Okay, back to chapter 10. Solomon's description of the fool is also a little bit comical, although tragic. Verse 15, the labor of fools wearies them. For they do not even know how to go to the city. We sometimes say that a person could not find his way out of a paper bag or something of that. Solomon is just saying to hear the fool. He can't even find his way into the city. But he thinks he can, doesn't he? Now, he's full of words. He's full of all kinds of advice. He's full of things he thinks everybody needs to hear. But again, babble, babble, feast in the morning. Now, the king may not be literally a child, but he may be what? Very, very immature. Not at all suited for the high rank, the office that he holds. And so woe to you, O land, whatever nation, whatever land is stuck with a king or a ruler like this is in trouble. Your princes feast in the morning. What's wrong with that?
And you're sleeping and drunk all day.
Now, he isn't talking about having breakfast, is he? He's talking about feasting. What comes first? Feasting is celebration. Or your work. Your work comes first. But here is the ruler and his princes who are playing at it. Do we have any familiarity with rulers that somehow or other think their office gives them privilege to play when they need to be tending to business? I think we can all find examples of that. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles, and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. This feasting that is described here is more than just having a super big celebratory meal. It describes proceeding with drunkenness. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar got too big for his riches, and God said he would lose his mind. There's this king of the Babylonian Empire, that he would feed with the beasts of the field. And Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind. Got so tickled us in the name of the commentator, Jim. Excellent writer. His name will come to me about 2 o'clock in the morning and I'll call him. But anyway, he was talking about Nebuchadnezzar and his situation out feeding with the beasts of the field. And he pictures an emissary from some other ruler coming to visit Nebuchadnezzar and being told, you'll have to wait. The king is out on the lawn having lunch. Eventually, Nebuchadnezzar's mind is restored when Nebuchadnezzar comes to his own senses and realizes that it is God who rules, not man in and of himself. Nebuchadnezzar eventually is succeeded, by a son, Nabonidus, and Nabonidus didn't like the responsibility of rulership very well, so he chose a regent to rule in his place, a fellow named Belshazzar. Remember him? Belshazzar is engaged in a drunken feast with all of his subjects. The Babylonians at this point had long before taken the people of Judah captive, had taken all of the riches, the golden vessels from the temple. And here is Belshazzar using these golden vessels that were designed to worship God to drink himself and his subject drunk. What happened?
Got a message.
The writing on the wall telling Nebuchadnezzar, you're all through. And that very night, the Persians and the Medians came in and took the Babylonian city or the city of Babylon and the Babylonian Empire. Took it without a fight. And all of the subjects, all of the rulers, stone drunk. Pretty good example of a king not paying attention to business. Okay. Let's go back for a moment to Proverbs. This particular proverb was not written by Solomon, but included in the wisdom of the Proverbs. These are the words of King Lemuel, according to the text, the utterance which his mother taught him. In verse 4, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink. Well, it sounds like the same thing, but they're not. Wine was the common table drink of that day, and still in many places in the East. But taken in excess, what can it produce? Intoxication. Strong drink here is from the Hebrew word shikar, and it is wine that has been fortified with drugs, or it may refer to drinks that are derived from grain, alcohol, strong drink. It is not for kings to play around with this stuff. Why not? Because it affects the judgment. Exactly. And, in our time, in news stories, do you ever see televised pictures of a high state conference or dinner or gathering? What is prevalent? Alcohol. Alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. Washington, D.C., and just about every other state house anywhere swims in alcohol. Sometimes we wonder why some really ridiculous, if not disastrous, decisions are made at high levels of government. Might be a good idea to put down the booze, put down the plague, and get down to business. Would that hurt anything? Just might help, don't you think? But lest they drink, I'm still back at the Proverbs 31. Lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Lemuel here is not advising that it be done literally, just saying if it belongs anywhere, this is where it belongs. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. But how about kings? Pay attention to business, to what your responsibility is. Okay, back to Ecclesiastes 10. First part of verse 17, blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles. I don't think you could that Solomon here is using the word noble in the sense of status, of rank in society, but rather saying that this man be a son of nobility. Noble in character, and as a consequence, responsible, capable, able to take care of business. Because of laziness, the building decays. I've dropped on down through the latter part of verse 17. I think we've discussed that principle adequately. But in verse 18, because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. Boy, that happens, doesn't it? We've seen examples of that. People living in a place that should be a pretty nice place. But what happens to any place if it's not maintained? It deteriorates. It turns into a mess. And all because of the laziness or because of simply the neglect of those who should be taken care of. At verse 19, a feast is made for laughter, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. Well, that's an interesting statement, and I'm not just dead sure exactly what Solomon is getting at. But when he makes the statement, a feast is made for laughter, okay, it's a time of celebration and joy. Wine makes merry, and it can do that. It can also be used to excess, even where it is used as a common table drink. But this statement, money answers everything. How do you take that?
love of things.
All right. That no matter what the situation, if we've got enough money, we can buy our way out of it. Okay, and I think that's one take on it already. And I would not at all say that that's mistaken. That's maybe well what Solomon had in mind. But is there any other way to take this?
Could it be he's being a little sarcastic?
But sure.
Could it be that he's being a little sarcastic there and saying?
Yeah, I think that would go along with what Lee's saying, a little bit of irony or sarcasm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, Dean?
Well, if you look at that on the flip side, you back up and look at the context, woe unto you, O land, when your king is a child, when your prince is feeds in mourning, and then it goes on to talk about the things that you talk about. Blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles. So if the king is doing his job as a king, and not feasting, and not being merry, and not wasting his time on frivolous things, his country is going to prosper.
Okay.
And what I read out of this was that money is, that money answers everything. That the kingdom prospering answers all those questions. It shows the world that king is not wasting his time on drink and wine, that he is doing the things necessary for his people to...
A prosperous nation and able them to use that for progress.
Yeah, right. That's how I read it.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. Well, let's take a look at Luke, the 16th chapter. One writer that I read offered this as a possible explanation, and it may be. I think hopefully we're familiar with the story here. That Jesus talked about a certain rich man, Luke 16, verse 1. He had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. Steward is not taking care of his master's goods, and so he's in trouble. He owes lots and lots, and so he begins then to figure out ways to settle the debt and be able to settle things with his master. Now, how Jesus applies this? Verse 8, so the master, this is Luke 16, verse 8, so the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. Now, Jesus, of course, is not suggesting, he's not advising that we take on the antics of this unjust steward, but he is drawing an example. And verse 9, and I say to you, he's talking to his disciples, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon. In other words, the material things of this world. That when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, that is, in the use of material goods and wealth, who will commit to you, who will commit to your trust the true riches? But if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and man. But use man for what? Preparation for its proper purpose in this life, providing the things that are necessary, not making a god of it, but using it for the purpose that God gave it, not letting it be our master, but using it for what the master has stipulated so that we may be sustained. If that's what Solomon is talking about. Maybe, as I said earlier, I'm not taking an arbitrary position on this because I don't know. I think any of the things that have been suggested here are possible. So think about it. verse 20, last verse of the chapter, do not curse the king, even in your flock. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedrooms. Why not? Does that mean I have to agree with the king all the time? No. But
God put him in.
Don't babble, babble, babble.
God put him in places.
And you can't serve the other of the one who has the ability to do you in, can't you? And so, that seems to be what Solomon is driving at. Put a bird in the air. Now, how is this ever going to get to the king? Now, here I am bad-mouthing him and saying things that shouldn't be said. And that could even be taken as perhaps insurrection, rebellion, threats against the king. Is this ever going to get to him? Well, a bird in the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. Bird was literally going to do that? No, but somehow or other it gets to him. I got to tell you a quick story. There used to be a fellow over in Redmond. Actually, he lived between Biz and Redmond, and his son had a pole business. He took a lot of pole pines, and he would strip it and make poles out of it for fencing and for other purposes. His name was Maglich, an interesting old character. He had ridden with the army when they were out after Pancho Villa, you know, back in the old days. And Martin invited me to speak to a fourth grade class once at Juniper Elementary School in Bend, and he got started, and the kids loved him, and Marge just had a terrible time getting him turned off so she could get his kids to match what they were supposed to be doing. But he was an interesting old boy. But Richard Nixon was running for the presidency, and he made a stop in Redmond, the little airport there. And of course, they had everybody back behind the cyclone fencing. And Nixon gets off of the plane, and he's waving to the crowd and all that. And the old Baker is standing there, and he says, you know, he's just talking out loud to himself. He says, I've killed a lot of critters in my day, but I've never shot a president. A Secret Service man standing right next to him. All this old guy off. They ran him through the ringer. Luckily, he wasn't carrying a firearm. They probably had him in prison for the rest of his life. But be careful. You know, he can get back. You know, comes out to you next time. Okay, our time is just about up. And so we'll save the 2 minutes that are still on the clock so Larry can use them next week if he wants to. Thanks so much to everybody for your attention, for your participation in the class. And let's be dismissed in prayer. Dean, would you lead